Class will come to order. The professor always begins on time, Sandy, don't I?
Yes.
Yes. And yes, there will be something on the final from this lecture this morning. It's been a while since I've done that. My name is David Woodard. I am in the new members class, and I'm thinking that I may be kicked out after Scott and David get through working me over here. I passed out some notes on my lecture with a map. If you need one, please raise your hand and I'll try and...
Here, I'll do that for you.
Thank you, brother. We're going to run out, I can tell you right now. If you can share... I am a professor of political science, retired from Clemson University, and part of my field was in racial relations. My doctoral dissertation was on that, and I still work some in the field. And so Scott and David asked me to participate in this conference, and I was very glad to do it. But I'm beginning in an old place. With this book, it looks like one that professors would have on their shelf. It has 1,000 pages. And it begins in the book, and it was written by Augustine, who was a 5th century apologist. He was called by Time magazine, I think mistakenly, as the second founder of the faith. That's because the City of God and his confessions were foundational works in early Christianity. And he provided a great defense of the faith in the time of a crisis. His problem was much like the one we face today. Christianity had been ignored, and then it was blamed for the problems of the times. And he had to respond. And he did. And as one of my professors said, when he did not require it in my graduate work, but when he found out that I taught it, he said, "I can't believe you read the whole thing." I kind of agree with him. The rulers of Rome liked to proclaim that their empire had lasted 1,000 years. The Republic began in 506 B.C. when a number of prominent families assembled in a semi-democratic society to deliberate about Rome. And it went that way as the practice of a republic. You can look back at who ruled Rome during that time, and there are familiar names that come back in until 27 B.C., when Julius Caesar declared himself to be the emperor, and his assassination led to a civil war. And that civil war stretched until Octavian assumed the throne of Caesar Augustus. We're introduced to Caesar Augustus in Luke 2, when Scripture says, "Joseph and Mary went to Bethlehem to be registered in the census. Augustus established a dictatorship and ruled for 40 years. We have become familiar, those of us who have been in churches over the time, with many of the successors to Augustus. They're sometimes mentioned in sermons. Tiberius, Claudius, Nero, and others. But the most important may have been Constantine, who converted to Christianity before a battle, and in 312 AD, after victory, he declared the faith to be the official state-protected religion of Rome." What a placement after they had been persecuted for 300 years. At the time, Rome symbolized security for the civilized way of life. In what I have passed out, if you look at the map, you will see that is the last time the Mediterranean world was ruled by one power. Never since then has it happened. And Justin Martyr, who died in the second century, said, "The emperor's best helpers and allies are Christians because they believe in submission to the authorities they had over them." How shocking it was then when Alaric the Visigoth sacked Rome in 410 AD. How bad was it? He took 100 wagon loads of goods out. The rumor was they were all full of gold and silver. They probably weren't. They probably had some clothing and rugs and furniture and other things in there. But it was said at the time it didn't diminish the wealth of Rome at all to have 100 wagon loads taken out. The Christian apologist Jerome, living at the time, wrote this: "The brightest light of the world was put out." Remember, the Christians were Romans. It was the end of an era. The elite of Rome, the sophisticated, the wealthy, the well-educated and the people of power came to one conclusion. Christianity, with its power, its pious encouragement to turn the other cheek, to forgive your oppressors, to seek consolation, it was responsible for the collapse. The educated and once powerful wanted to return to the good old days, the circus shows of triumph, like in the movie Gladiator, which is out there now, strong, dominant leaders. And so what if the worship of the emperor was required? He was like a god, and the peace of Rome was everywhere. Those were the good old days. Augustine knew the complaint, and he knew what it meant. The refugees from Rome came to Hippo, the little town I put a dot for in North Africa there. And they called the Christians the Hippo sheep. But their leader knew how to hunt wolves, and they had stumbled into Augustine's place. He was not passive, but he knew one thing. He could not present the Christian case until he first destroyed the arguments that blamed the church for the fall of Rome, the loss of empire. So he turned first to Roman thought. That's why this 1,000-page book is divided into two parts. The first part is a critique of Rome, and a second is a presentation of the gospel. Today, unless you get an academic book, the first part is usually omitted. It's not relevant anymore. If you buy The City of God, it has his apology in the second part. But I think the first part is important. In it, Augustine documented that the pagan gods had nothing to give. They could not protect or save Rome. Astrology was useless. Greek philosophy was empty. And after he had laid bare all the things that Rome held dear, he turned to present the gospel. But the critique came first. And he knew that no one would come forward to the church until the idols of their own heart and their questions were answered about cultural values. Popular beliefs have been critiqued before, but they were abandoned. The Romans believed in something that didn't work. And what was worse is they wanted to return to it. The refugees in Augustine's time came to little old Hippo in North Africa. all the way from Rome. It'd be like the residents of Manhattan and those who live in the Gold Coast of Chicago coming to Walhalla. It's remote, it's uncultured, but it's safe. But they stumbled on a pastor named Augustine, and he shows all of us it's not where you are, it's what you say that counts. Unlike the 5th century today in Western culture, we live in a time when we have two Romes, two different conceptions of reality that are with us here. I introduce them with the iPhone, that's modernity, and with this book, Critical Race Theory, which I'll refer to a few times, and it has in front of it all the other aspects of postmodern thought. But let's begin with the modern era. Most of us are familiar with it who are Christians, especially if we've studied apologetics in our own time. It's symbolized by this remarkable incident, this remarkable instrument. I'm old enough to remember Dick Tracy. I don't think many other people do. But Dick Tracy had a magic watch that he would look at and talk back to headquarters. I thought it would never happen. It has in my own lifetime. it's a great triumph. Modernism is defined as beginning with the European Enlightenment of the 1750s. It's oftentimes associated with France, mistakenly. There was also an English Enlightenment and even a Scottish Enlightenment. But the emphasis on industrialization, the rise of capitalism, a great faith in reason, human improvement, science and technology, and the iPhone came from modernity. The new thinking extended into social arrangements, the rise of representative democracy. And what about God? We don't need him anymore. We have a new God. Science. We have human improvement in science. An autonomous man solving problems without need of a deity. Now, we had a debate back and forth between Christians for the past 250 years on this, going back to evolution and what have you. But I think it was summarized by Henry Luce, who wrote in Time magazine, that the 20th century was going to be the American century. He wrote that in 1941, the beginning of World War II, and he was right. Became the American century. At the end of the Second World War, the U.S. had more GDP than any other country in the world, and no other country in the world had one as big as General Motors. That's how dominant the U.S. was. And it took root in a Christian character, but it was fading under modernity. At the end of the 20th century, modernity began to fade itself. Nuclear weapons, pollution, decreasing natural resources, germ warfare, decreasing confidence and faith and reason led to the rise of postmodernity. Doug Coupland, who is a popular writer for the young, wrote in his book, Life After God, in 1994, that you are the first generation raised without religion. He was pretty much right. Welcome to the postmodern world that wants to remake not just science, but culture, everything. In the first page of CRT, let me read some other books that are in the series. The First Amendment in a Cross-Cultural Perspective, Feminist Legal History, The Emergence of Mexican America, how corporate government law has kept women out of the boardroom, the legal construction of race, the representative rights leader in law and in medicine, Chicago students, Chicano students in the courts. The new way of thinking is postmodern. It has a distrust of science, a skepticism about anything from the past. There's no such thing as acceptable knowledge anymore. The same thing is not true for all social groups, cultures, traditions, and races. Truth is relative. Instead of an absolute structure, we should embrace randomness, playfulness, fragmentation, and in the words of my son's generation, whatever. The authority of science, rationality in the past aren't accurate. No one explanation can claim to be valid for all social groups. One student told me before I retired from the university, "We don't want to be talked at by people like you." That'll make you feel real good before you leave. You begin with several statements you never thought you would hear, like, "I'm a woman trapped in a man's body." Welcome to today's world. Welcome to postmodernism. Postmodernism is an attempt to rethink the basic concepts of our culture, the most basic, who we are, what reality is, how it can be explained. The accepted norms of the past are out of date. Christianity is obsolete. In my 35 years of teaching, I always signed up on the little list the first of the year that said Christian professors and everything. I never had anyone challenge me. None of my colleagues ever challenged me. One of them told me this: "Go to church. Sing your songs, pray, even go to heaven. I don't care. Just don't try and tell me that anything from those beliefs matters now in here," meaning the classroom. That's critical America. And CRT is part of a larger whole. We can't understand it apart from the rest of the things. The essence of knowing in a postmodern world is to question grand meta-narratives that are generally accepted but need to be defrocked. Everywhere the culture is telling us this, and nowhere is it telling it more than in the movies. 2 decades ago, the movie American Beauty won Best Picture. A telesales operator becomes disillusioned with his life. So Lester Burnham reverts to his childhood, decides to start over. He works at a fast food restaurant. He uses drugs. He buys the hot car he always wanted but could never afford. He works out every day, and he longs to seduce the high school cheerleader. The only happy couple in the whole neighborhood as you watch the movie is the homosexual one. The 1991 Oscar winner introduces us to postmodernism. Here it comes. It's not that something is wrong. It's that everything is wrong. Lots of people wanted to kill Lester Burnham in the movie. All right, Woodard, how does Lester Burnham relate to critical race theory? First point, critical race theory is part of an amalgamation of a lot of other thinking, but they all have the same theme. What is accepted in our society, in law and society, is all a part of an essentially racist structure that maintains social, political, and economic inequalities in society. In the liberal arts and humanities curriculum now on campus, the university wants to demask the lies that are at the heart of past learning, social determinism, the ideas that, as critical race theory says on page 31, our system, by reason of its structure and vocabulary, is ill-equipped to address wrongs. In the new education at the university, the essence of knowing is to question things that have been accepted and think of something new. Take someone like Martin Luther King Jr. I'm glad David mentioned him in the sermon this morning. An admittedly liberal pastor, but he used nonviolence to strike at the conscience of white-going church Southerners. Some policemen took their hats off during the prayers when he led demonstrations. The only pastor in American history with a national holiday named for him is criticized by CRT because he accepted federal legislation, the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the 1965 Voting Rights Act. They were compromises, say the CRT critics, not achievements. Here, let me read from page 49. Our most prized legal doctrines and protections are shams, hollow pronouncements issued with great solemnity and fanfare. In the 21st century, Martin Luther King Jr. is an embarrassment. And to make things worse, he's a pastor. Another criticism. To be educated is to be made aware of the social and legal practices in the society. You know, those practices that oppress. Satch Jenkins, a filmmaker with a new series on Showtime entitled Everything's Going to Be All White. It's a critique with academics, cultural commentators, and artists presenting the history of America from a racial minority point of view. The film expresses the CRT point of view, page 86. The literature and popular culture all reinforce white superiority in law, courts, reading, and popular media, the superiority of the white position. The postmodern themes are repeating and endless in this series. In the liberal arts and humanity courses on campus, race is more important than grades, than academic accomplishment, or so-called ability. We don't know about student aptitude. Why? Because the tests are biased. The rule is that if a minority student overcame white domination and privilege to enter college with all the stereotypes in which college has, then they're superior to racially biased ideas from any professor. Remember what was said. We don't want to be talked at by people like you. Just like Augustine analyzed Rome for what it was, I think our task before us as Christians is very clear. The CRT book is riddled with selective examples. David mentioned one this morning in the sermon. The system of racial segregation in the South was overcome by people on their knees. And the system of apartheid in South Africa existed from 1948 to the 1990s. The U.S. State Department was not seeking diplomats to be sent to South Africa when they did away with apartheid. they paved the way for American pastors to go to South Africa and speak to the white minority about the black majority. It worked. There was a peaceful transfer of power. Won the Nobel Prize. There are many ways and examples to refute CRT. The one that sticks with me is the Rwandan Civil War that went on from 1990 to 1994. The dispute between Hutu and Tutsi groups ended with between 500,000 and 800,000 civilians killed. 800,000 dead. And why? Because as Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, pride grows in the human heart like lard in a pig. Race and ethnicity are themselves subject to the whims of the heart. David said it very well this morning. All animosity, racial and otherwise, comes from our sinful nature. Christians have the real answer, and the events show that we're the only ones that can solve the problems. Our question and my question, what has happened to the church in the time of this crisis? Where is our Augustine, someone who will write and talk about the dominant thinking in Rome? In Christian history, we have constant stories of people overcoming prejudice and leading to reconciliation, not just declaring it, but living it out by their lives. Think of William Wilberforce. That was the most profitable business in England at the time, the slave trade was. He wasn't just going against racial prejudice, he was going against an entire economic structure that benefited. He never relented. Hudson Taylor in China was said the sun never rose in China, that Hudson Taylor wasn't on his knees. How many converts did he have during his ministry? Almost none. But that's how the church got started in China. And I think Martin Luther King's voice of reconciliation in the South was the one key thing that worked and solved a problem that no one could do. The postmodern situation can be stated for the church in one sentence. A baptized nation is following the gods of our age. We live in a world that is rapidly changing. But to Christians, it's also collapsing. The Christian faith, Christian ideas, Christian standards and beliefs, from everything from marriage to how we raise children to what should be in school to how we should live, is constantly under attack. And it is more and more absent from the standards and beliefs in parts of our country. Increasingly, postmodern means post-Christian, and the replacement of faith by the secular welfare state is the solution. There are frightening statistics. The U.S. birth rate has been in decline since 2008. The replacement rate is 2.1 births per marriage. It is currently at 1.6. A new low. 40% of the births are outside of marriage. And when you look at different racial groups, it's going up in all of them. Statistics say the average age for women getting married is 25 and 28 for men. As someone who's taught college for over 30 years, it's not the same for them. They're later, oftentimes 30. Sometimes later. Go to church and you will hear that Christ is the center of the world. Unless you have him, you have no life. And walk outside the church. Turn on the television. Read an article about politics. or about business, or maybe about art, and there is no mention, there is no need for God. It is a world without God, and the young people are abandoning it, abandoning Him. They live in what one social scientist called a buffered self, a person isolated from the transcendent and having no contact with it. Today, 21% of Americans identify with having no religious preference. In 2000, it was 8%. Who's having a great effect on America's culture today? Is it college ministers or the author of Life After God? I'd say it's the author of Life After God. It is the most recent finding that for the first time, U.S. church membership has fallen below a majority. It's down 20 points from where it was at the turn of the century. We here, and I am joining this effort, are trying to build a Christian church when Christianity as a worldview is in decline in our culture, and we must face that first. C.S. Lewis once said, we don't need more books by Christians about Christianity. We need more books about subjects where Christianity labors. It's a great cry. Unfortunately, the church has adopted an ingrown fortress mentality during this time. We're absorbed with our own piety, our personal growth. In a word, we're absorbed with ourselves. The modern super-spiritualized Christianity avoids contact with the present world. I refer to this version, says Thaddeus J. Williams in a book that Scott introduced here on Friday night, as one in which the whole point is to simply float off into the clouds after we die. It's like Augustine writing the City of God without the first 10 chapters. On the basis of Rome, we build from the rubble. The cultural icons of our time, names like Friedrich Nietzsche, Jacques Derrida, Michel Foucault, and I don't have to tell this to the students, dominate the college culture. They are likewise in magazines and political speeches, subject of movies and television, the lyrics of popular songs. They're everywhere, but they are never discussed at church, and that is a shortcoming. One example shows how much we're isolated. The architecture of churches in Europe from the 12th to the 16th century were called Gothic. The height, the flying buttresses, the stained glass windows. If you've been in them, and I've been in too few of them, you have awe immediately when you walk in. Today, many churches are designed like bunkers, some without windows outside, because the focus isn't outside. The focus is on the inside, on the emotions and feelings of the person attending. What matters is mood, experience, and the music. A video introduction on a screen, the lighting, and even the sermon. Alan Noble has written a book about churches, not any churches, evangelical Bible-believing churches. He says, the point is that our past models almost all assumed a listener who was active, attentive, and aware of the costs of believing. But in a disrupted world, the person attending just wants to be entertained. In such an environment, we must emphasize the most basic beliefs of Christianity, and we must have a lifestyle that gives evidence of it in what we say and what we think and how we behave. The values of truth, not just belief, are something that is eternal. The values of marriage, a covenant before a living God, not having sex and beauty in a snowflake, in a home of hospitality, in a person sanctified by Christ and growing in grace, in a painting that shows that person, not a collage, not an advertisement, not a gecko. Fear is the price we will pay to be different. A sermon on Matthew 5:11 is in order. You are the salt of the earth, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything. Scott put up a quote by Francis Schaeffer, whom I've read much of. And one of the things that most challenged me is he wrote that confronting the culture is costly. He said that being a Christian believer is not a contest, it's not a tournament, it's not a sport, it's a war. The de-Christianization of our world is too important for us not to have something to say. I'm a professor of politics. I've read about the middle-class Germans who worshipped in their state-approved Lutheran churches in the 1930s and the 1940s. They never brought their faith to bear on Nazism, and they paid a terrible price for their neglect. We must be salting salt that stands for the most basic things when they are unpopular and when they are under assault. If you interviewed Augustine at the end of his life, I think he'd tell you that he failed. 30 years, he was a heretic. His mother Monica prayed for him. After his conversion, he helped establish a place and sent his best friends to populate churches in North Africa. They were tortured, put on the walls when the Arian heretics came through, and staked outside as a show of destruction. They were around the city where Augustine died. They were besieging it. He told his students to get rid of his books. Fortunately, the graduate students didn't do that. And we have his confessions. And we have the city of God. It survives to this day. It is not God's work. It is not Augustine's work. It's God's work. And he will see it through to conclusion. I'm very thankful as a new member for the session and pastoral staff of this church. Scott Cook is presenting Genesis. If you write books and you send them to a publisher, the first thing they say is, you've got a lousy beginning. The beginning is the key to the book. In the beginning, God created. That's the beginning of the book. Jesus is called the second Adam, but you can't understand him without knowing about the first Adam. David Sinclair is leading us through Acts, but this isn't the magical mystery tour. And if you want to come to hear success, wear a belt. In 2 Corinthians, he says, of the Jews, 5 times I received 40 stripes, 3 times beaten with rods, 1 stoned, 2 shipwrecked, journeys of peril, of waters, robbers, the wilderness, weariness, painfulness, hunger, thirst, fasting, often in cold and nakedness. That's what it's like to be a follower of Christ. He goes to Athens. I know about Athens. That's where Plato, Aristotle, Socrates were 400 years earlier. It infested the whole community. Does he go in and say, you believe in Plato? I believe in God. We can talk. Read Acts 17. He says, there is a creator and it is the Lord God. And he never once says, you're all wrong, but it's all implied, and he doesn't get to finish his sermon. Then what does he do? He goes to Ephesus. Oh, there's a great place to go to. They've made a manufacturing history for 200 years of making idols that they're still finding by archaeologists in the Mediterranean today. And what happens? He creates a riot. He's saved. But he tells them they're living bogus lives. I'll close by reading the first books of Augustine. 1,500 years ago. They should guide us. Here, my dear Marcellinus, is the fulfillment of my promise to you. A book in which I have taken upon myself the task of defending the glorious city of God against those who prefer their own gods to the founder of that city. That was the task of Augustine. It is our task. God will see us through. Now, I tried to leave a few minutes for questions, but I've done this enough to know that the first one usually has to be kind of coached. So hopefully not. Let's have the first question. Well, I knew it. In my class, I would sometimes say, we're not getting out early until you ask a question.
Can I use that?
That's a great thing to do. You get pretty stupid questions, but at least they ask them.
I'll ask a question.
Yes, sir. Yeah. Well, let me tell you, we have some pastors here. I have to be very careful. Pastors want to grow their church. The best way to grow the church is to accommodate the culture. If people want to be entertained, entertain them. And the idea of appealing to their soul directly is not going to get you that pay raise you want. I was on the examining committee of a local Presbyterian group for 5 terms. I always asked them what they're teaching, and they always had good answers. I watched them in their ministry, and they want to sing and dance. I have found a hope. There are Bible-believing pastors in Europe that are basically saying, it doesn't work. We're going to go back to the Bible. We're going to preach these things. That's what Christianity is about. I don't know an easy answer to your question, but when you go to General Assembly in your denomination and you see these pastors that have churches of 4,000 and 5,000 that you think need to be cleaned up, it's hard to tell them. It's hard to tell them. Odie.
Yeah, question. You were mentioning and talking about how postmodernism has infected American culture in particular.
Yeah.
And as you were talking about the fragmentation and the your truth is, you know, your truth and your truth is, you know, all that postmodernism stuff, one of the things that really struck me is this past 2 years, we have been in the middle of a pandemic. Yeah. And one of the things that has really struck me about this pandemic is that the fear of death has been brought front and center. Are there any statistics where people are, you know, I mean, I don't know, maybe it's too soon to tell. What are the impacts of this fear of death brought about through the pandemic on our postmodern culture? Are there any impacts? Has it just been a blip in history?
See, I'm...
Maybe it's just too soon to tell. We don't have the details yet.
Well,
I don't know.
I don't know this, but I do know. I will answer you this way. In the medieval times, the monks slept in their coffins. You know why? Because they knew what the end was.
Yeah.
I think in this church, we talk about what the end is. And I think that's really important. Because the beginning is when you know the end.
Yeah.
That helps. We have a course on marriage. We have a course on various other things. We don't have a course on death. I think that would be great.
Well, and one of the things, you know, you mentioned Francis Schaeffer. Francis Schaeffer in his evangelism always talked about taking the roof off. In other words, taking the non-Christian and saying, look it, your presuppositions don't work in reality.
That's right.
And this idea of we're all going to die.
Yeah.
That right there is such an affront to postmodernism.
It is.
Huge.
It is.
Huge affront.
And Scott is preaching another affront. Made in the image of God.
Yes.
Wait. I'm made in the image of myself, not of God.
Yeah.
Maybe ending on made in the image of God is the best thing. It is 10:30. Is this the time for me to stop here, Pastor? Look, thank you very much for putting up. It's been a while since I've gotten behind the lectern. I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.